The following interview was recorded for CFRO The Pulse, Vancouver Co-op Radio's daily news show. The Pulse airs Monday to Friday at 7 a.m. on 100.5 FM and streaming live at coopradio.org.
On the program today, we're talking about a newly opened parklet for drinking. It's opened on 111 Princess Avenue, adjoining the Portland Hotel Society's community-managed alcohol program. And it's open to anyone who participates in their programs as of last week. According to Russ Maynard, the community engagement lead with PHS, the program is an innovative way of helping people be safe during a pandemic while drinking together in a responsible way. Russ, thank you so much for joining us here on The Pulse on Co-op Radio.
My pleasure.
One of the things that I think a lot of people in the neighborhood know about, but is kind of taken for granted, is this Drinker's Lounge and the community managed alcohol program.
With the overdose crisis, I do get asked to share my views on that topic, the overdose crisis. And so I'll often use alcohol as a, just as a kind of a visceral bridge, because people get alcohol. They just don't think of it as a drug. Yet it is a really significant drug. And that is has a much bigger impact on society than drugs do. But drugs get all the attention, and just that term drugs or the term heroin or cocaine have so much baggage, whereas alcohol has baggage, but it also has cachet and decades and decades, if not generations, of advertising and identification with it.
Not to mention legalization.
Exactly. And so it makes it, if you can get someone onto the topic of alcohol as a general topic in the conversation on drugs, then you can move all kinds of places, like you just did, to an example of a substance that has much bigger impact, negative impact on society. Yet we manage to, you could debate how successful we are, but undoubtedly we manage and control the quality of and the distribution of that substance.
Mm. It is a substance that does continue to tear apart people's lives in different ways and is addictive like other substances. Tell us a little bit about the CMAP program. How did it start and what's the kind of vision behind it?
Well, let's transition to that. I just want to finish that thought that you just made to add that one of the aspects of alcohol that's less covered is that it's also, the fastest growing lifestyle disease in North America or in the developed world is definitely diabetes and cancers. And both of those, alcohol is a big driver of.
About CMAP. How did it start?
CMAP started very organically. We had a drop-in, PHS ran a drop-in center right on Oppenheimer Park that was called the Drug Users Resource Center, DURC, D-U-R-C. And it was a drop-in center in the full sense of that term. And the park has been for decades, 40, 50 years even, a site for outdoor drinking. It's always been, for at least in the time span I just described, a low-income neighborhood. So that's where people would gather on the grass, especially in good weather, to socialize and have a drink. And when we opened the drop-in center there, of course, drinkers would come in to use the washroom or to get a coffee. And a good drop-in center reacts to the needs of the people that are, quote-unquote, dropping in. And that's the beginning of CMAP. We were trying to program and respond to the needs of the drinkers who are coming in. And again, compared to responding to the needs of drug users are much more straightforward. Alcohol tends to or can potentially bring out some unruly behaviors and argumentative behaviors and even violent behaviors. So it becomes very important to manage any of those potentials early on in when they start to show. And that was the beginning of CMAP, was trying to respond to the drinkers. And a lot of the drinkers were coming in, for instance, with what's called non-beverage alcohol, so mouthwash or more commonly nowadays, hand sanitizers.
Rubbing alcohol, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And so we were just like, how do we get folks to not drink? Like a pure harm reduction perspective is, how do you get people to not consume something that's not designed to be consumed and is really hard on you because of that, and move them to something that is designed to be consumed, what's called beverage alcohol. So everything.
What's the danger, the harm health-wise in drinking things like hand sanitizer, rubbing alcohol, mouthwash?
One could make the argument that it's somewhat analogous to the situation or the problems that we're having with fentanyl. It's just such a much more concentrated alcohol. So alcohol is alcohol, and the alcohol in those products, although maybe slightly chemically different, I'm not a chemist, I don't want to go in down that road, but ultimately it's alcohol. But it's alcohol that's in a form that is just so hard on your digestive tract and your body and your liver, which has to process that. So the byproducts of alcohol are what really ravage our body, not the alcohol itself. As it breaks down in our body, the metabolites are what really play havoc with our body and create chronic medical conditions. And all of that stuff is just made more complex and sped up by substances like hand sanitizer, mouthwash, things that have high alcohol content, usually to give them the quality of dissipating really quickly.
I'm a scotch drinker, and I know that when you're distilling, you are purifying and removing a lot of the really hard ethanol and formaldehyde and all these chemicals that can come out through the alcohol making process that aren't good to drink.
Yes, right.
And those things are dangerous. So when you take a harm reduction approach to alcohol, tell us a bit about what that looks like, because from what I've heard from the stories of participants, it's quite an innovative program I haven't seen anywhere else.
Yeah, so the first and most important thing that a community effort can do is, first of all, say to people who are largely shunned in society, and that is people who are poor and drink in public. So, I mean, just think about what aspect of drinking makes it illegal. If I walk into the Astoria or some beer store somewhere or alcohol store off sales, I'm doing a totally legal transaction. I buy something that's legal and regulated, and I walk outside. I'm still all above ground in terms of the law. But the minute I open that and take a drink of it on a sidewalk, in a park, on a beach, I'm breaking the law, and I've now moved into the illicit consumption of alcohol. And so people who are poor, homeless, or live in an SRO, like a single room occupancy hotel on the downtown east side, that may or may not allow guests, or even if it allows guests, your room is so tiny, it's hard to have guests. And for the folks we're talking about, it's the exact same social lubricant to some degree as all of us think of it as. I want to be with friends. I want to talk with friends and reminisce while I'm having a drink. And so when I do that in a park or out on the sidewalk, I'm now at risk of interventions with the police, going to drunk tanks, having everything poured out in front of me, and on and on and on. So if you can make a place for those folks where they can come inside, and then it's not illegal. And once people are inside and gathering, which is community 101, that's the most basic piece of creating and supporting and building community, is creating places where people can gather and share their lives and their stories with each other and just start to build that culture. So that at Drug Users Resource Center, that's what was happening. It was trying to create a place for the drinkers to come in and call their own and be welcome and be valued. And as that evolved over time, what became apparent was, if we wanted to get drinkers off of the cheapest forms of alcohol, which was mouthwash and hand sanitizer, etc., then you had to be able to offer something that fit their economic demographic, like just how much money do I have in my pocket and what you're offering is going to cost me more.
So is this how the trading program kind of began?
That's how the trading program, and but more important, to be able to trade you something. If we have to buy retail alcohol for a program that's not supported by the funders, the public health funders that an NGO would typically turn to, and you're funding everything just as a kind of cooperative. So the people using the service are pooling their resources. And that's how we ended up developing what's still called to this day, and this probably 10 years now, is called the Brewers Co-op. And we just followed the what do you call those local places that are all over the city where you could go?
Like brewmasters, the wine and beer kit places.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And we, at first, we were like, oh, let's go make wine or beer there. It's so much cheaper. But it was actually a lot of manual, a lot of work. And how do you pay people to do all that? So eventually, the people who are running the drop-in center in those early days said, what about asking the folks who do the drinking? And no one would, in those days, have thought those folks you see in the lying on the sidewalk or lying in the park, would have the wherewithal to learn how to do it. And you've got to keep everything clean or people can get ill and so on and so forth. All kinds of details to be an eye kept on. But 10 years later, they're still doing that. And so the folks that pool their money do the brewing and do the cleaning and watch the maintenance of the equipment and et cetera, et cetera.
So how big a setup do you have in terms of the equipment? Like, it's a fair bit of stuff. I've never got into it myself because of how many carboys and sterilizing gear you need, but it's a fair bit of stuff.
Yeah, and you know, we don't, it's not like if you walk into one of the popular breweries and there's stainless steel structures everywhere. It's not like that. It's like what you're describing. It's plastic carboys and the various containers and tools you need to do that, to measure sugar content and oxygen content, things like that. But all those things have been around for hundreds of years, and we understand them well, and they're fairly straightforward. And the master brewers mentor the newer brewers, and that's how the process just keeps going over a long period of time. But yeah, it's a modest setup, and it's set up in a room, and you have to have access to water and that kind of thing for obvious reasons and for cleaning. And that's what it looks like, a room full of plastic equipment.
So this kind of grew or fermented, if you will, from just a straight drop-in and then a trade-in program to being something that's actually a training program. What does it mean to the participants?
It's huge. Like, I won't use any names. I was having a conversation with someone I work with in a cultural program, and he shared with me a story about his mother, and who had recently passed away, but for years had been located in the downtown east side and was a drinker, and it weighed heavily on the family, worrying about her health and all the risks kind of in that lifestyle. But it's still somebody's mother and lots of love in that family. And that mother many years ago got connected to the program that we're talking about. And for the family, it was a huge relief to know that that their mother was somewhere that now the people around, if anything went south, if there were any problems, there were people to kind of intervene and just keep the peace. And if anybody fell down or was injured, to get help. Plus, I didn't even touch on this, but the program has always been connected to healthcare, PHS healthcare, and there just happened to be healthcare clinics close by. And we always work with people's needs to get them to family doctors.
Why is that particularly important for drinkers?
You know, your clinical language, there's a lot of comorbidities to that lifestyle, a lot of health complications. And so that's what this person was sharing with me. It was like, A, my mom was somewhere that I didn't have to worry about where she was. I know she was cared for and appreciated. And B, she kept regularly connecting with healthcare. And it was just such a much better solution than the alternative. And that's like harm reduction, is moving someone along on a continuum towards a better outcome. It's not abstinence. It's not perfect maybe by society's measures, but at least you're moving in a positive direction.
Many people who are alcoholics or struggle with substance use of many sorts, a lot of it is around numbing trauma or processing and coping with trauma. Is there an aspect of emotional support to the program that may help with that?
Absolutely. For sure there is. You know, it's humble because society doesn't create that situation where it's easy to get people, low-income people, to be frank, counseling, individual counseling, even group counseling is hard to come by. It exists at most of the clinics, but it's challenging. So instead, we do have cultural supports, Indigenous cultural supports, and then a lot of listening to each other. And when people are, there's grief and loss meetings because it, as we touched on earlier around morbidity, there's also a lot of mortality. It's a really hard life and people pass away regularly. So there's a lot of pain and loss in that population. And yeah, we address all of that. Anytime someone passes away, there's always a memorial so that the important signal is to the people that are left behind that all lives matter, and we're going to acknowledge all these lives and our loss.
Tell me a little bit about this parklet that's being being proposed for an outdoor drinking space, because that is the latest news on this, and it seems like a really interesting idea.
Yeah, the parklets seem to have come out of the pressures of COVID, so the safe places, if we're going to gather, are outside, where there's lots of air to dilute the so-called droplets that are such a risk amongst people. And so we have parklets all over the city. The more complicated part is when you want to allow people to legally drink in those parklets. That requires more steps and, for instance, bylaw amendments. And that's what really got into the newspaper, because we needed council to get involved in that. And luckily, council supported it. They recognized there'd be lots of support.
It got significant support from council, in fact, across party lines.
Exactly, yeah. And so I was just on the phone with some of the city staff that I work with, who are always great. And I was saying, hey, we've only had the parklet up and running for a few days, but I've already got a bunch of pictures of people with big smiles on their face. Because when COVID hit, so we've talked about Drinkers Lounge or the CMAP, the Community Managed Alcohol Program, and normally people go in through a door off the street, off the sidewalk, and into that program setting or that community setting. COVID hits, all of a sudden people can't be sharing rooms, 10 people in a room, that kind of thing. So we have to do something, and we had chairs outside and people were sitting outside under an awning. But to go back to stuff we've already talked about, technically that's illegal. And so moving towards the parklet, which is only feet away from the front door, it's the parking spots right in front of the building where this program is located, but it means that we can move people off of those chairs on the sidewalk into the parklet with more room for chairs and tables. And most importantly, it's not illegal. And it's well run and supported and cared for and cleaned. The furniture goes away at night when the program closes so that it doesn't attract people to be using the parklet when there isn't any supports. And all of those are nods to making it work with our neighbors and the city in general.
How significant a development is this to have a legalized outdoor drinking space for your members?
It's wonderful. I mean, there's the practical stuff, which we've talked about, space for people to gather, safety in a period of COVID. But the other part we haven't touched on, and I just hinted at it when I talked about the smiles that I've seen in the pictures, is it sends a signal to those folks that normally aren't welcome anywhere that, hey, they made a space for us. And it's a nice space, and it's right out in front of the building, and it's more, we're not hidden away. We don't seem to be quite as embarrassing to folks. And I wish I could introduce you to all the members. They're wonderful people. It's a pretty warm environment.
We would love to meet them sometime.
Yeah, come down.
Well, I'm wondering who is this parklet and the program available to, if people are interested who are listening?
Well, there are no criteria. The vast number of members. And any given day, there's between 10 and 20 people there. There's probably a core group of about 50 members who interact with the program any given week. You know, if we counted up all the people in a year that kind of touch base with the program and use it at some point, I think that number would be closer to 100 or 150. But at any given week, it's probably between 20 and 50 people interacting with the group, brewers, consumers, people dropping by, friends, that kind of thing. And I would say 100% of them are locals, people who live nearby.
What's the thing you're looking forward to most in the future with this program?
So as I said, the project's been around for about 10 years, and it's always been a Monday to Friday program, which was dictated by the amount of funding we could get to pay staff to run the program. But if you think about it, so it's a Monday-Friday kind of thing, daytime Monday to Friday for all these years. But it's not like drinkers stop drinking on the weekend.
In fact, the opposite at times.
Yeah, exactly. And when we come back to work on Monday, especially if you were talking to the GP who works in that building, Dr. Hirsch, she'd tell you that Monday morning is a tough morning because it's when the project's not around and people have to find other places to go. And so all those other problems that we were trying to solve, people going to parks or sidewalks, falling down, striking their head on the pavement, getting into skirmishes, interactions with police, all that kind of thing, is when she sees injuries and traumas and that kind of thing, blunt force traumas and issues like that. So we've always wanted to move to a 7-day-a-week model. And, you know, that's something that's in discussion right now. I don't know where that's going to go, but I hope that's one day that's where I want to get to, is that we can offer these folks a welcoming place 7 days a week. And then society at large will start working on the big problems, like you touched on, histories of trauma. Let's get rid of childhood poverty rates, which are so high in British Columbia when compared to other provinces, but also high in Canada as a G7 country. Let's address those problems and start to get at the root causes of these things.
When did the parklet officially open?
Might have been Tuesday, but it was either Monday or Tuesday. And officially, that's when it was installed. We still plan to have a kind of a celebratory opening day. We're just waiting to change. Along with the parklet, we're expanding the hours a bit longer in the daytime. So the program used to close at 3, now it'll wind up at 5. And so that requires some changes in staffing. And those dotting the I's and crossing the T's, that's not all finished, but close. And as soon as we do that, then we'll have a little party there, like a you know, cake and that kind of thing. And the parklet itself, with support from the city, they've been really wonderful. And we were asking, like, can we make it nicer than just concrete barriers? And they said, yeah, for sure. We'll help you with some planters. So eventually, we don't have them quite yet, but we'll have the planters soon. And the folks who use the parklet will also care for the planters and make sure they're watered all summer and that kind of thing.
Thank you so much for sharing more about this program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. Take care. And that was Russell Maynard. He is a community engagement lead at Portland Hotel Society Community Services.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.